And tonight we'll talk about psychic abilities with Chris Carter, author of several books, including Science and Psychic Phenomena, Science and the Near-Death Experience. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Let me tell you about Chris Carter, degrees in economics and philosophy from the University of Oxford. He's written several articles for respected journals, including the Journal for the Society for the Psychical Research and the Journal of Near-Death Studies as well. Noted author, as I mentioned, his title, Science and the Psychic Phenomena and Science and the Near-Death Experience. Here's Chris Carter on Coast to Coast. Good evening, Chris. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm looking forward to this. I've always been fascinated in psychic abilities. I take it you have too, haven't you?
Well, I've always been interested in controversial subjects. That's part of the reason why I decided to study philosophy, among other things, when I went to university. But when I first started out, I didn't have any particular interest in parapsychology.
What got you in that area?
When I was a student in England, in our second year, three other grad students and I moved into an old medieval farmhouse on the outskirts of town that had been owned by my college for centuries. And before we moved in, several people told us that the place was reputed to be haunted. And nothing malevolent, mind you. They told us about footsteps and unusual sounds, that sort of thing. But that was part of the reason why I wanted to move in. I was naturally curious about what was going on. And we did have some strange experiences, and so after I graduated, I started to wonder if serious research had actually been done into parapsychology and related topics. So when I got back to Canada, I visited some of our local libraries, and I was surprised to find that, for over 150 years, these topics have been rigorously researched and documented.
There's something behind it, Chris. There's no doubt about that. What is science starting to do about this? Anything?
Well, as I said, for about the past 130 years, scientists and philosophers and other scholars have taken a close look at these unusual phenomena. It really started in the late 1800s, or the early 1800s, say, with the formation of the British Society for Psychical Research in London, England. Then 2 years later, that was followed with the founding of the American Society for Psychical Research in Boston. And both organizations are still up and running today, and both continue to do good work.
Psychic abilities, what would your definition of that be, Chris?
Well, psychic abilities in the broad sense refer to any mental abilities. So a psychic ability could be the ability to do mathematics or to write music and so forth. But usually when we're talking about these sorts of psychic abilities, we're referring to basically two broad groups. What's known as extrasensory perception, and that would be abilities such as telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, which basically refers to the ability to perceive or transmit information without the use of our five ordinary senses. And then there's also psychokinesis, which refers to the alleged ability to influence objects without the use of our muscles. So together, extrasensory perception and psychokinesis are referred to collectively as psi. It's spelled PSI, but pronounced psi.
You've looked at some of the work by parapsychologists in these fields of psychic abilities. What have you uncovered?
What have I uncovered? I've looked not just at the experimental evidence. I also have a very interesting chapter on the historical evidence. And also then I've looked at the experimental evidence for abilities such as telepathy.
We used to have a university here that would devote itself to these studies out at Duke University. And I wish they were continuing to do things like that. Are you finding that academia is really not doing a thorough job studying psychic abilities anymore? They used to in the old days.
Well, it's difficult to say. I know that different universities around the world are still conducting research, and but I've also read that what was it now? I think that what was the figure?
How many?
I think that it's hard to
many.
Well, around the world right now, probably maybe a dozen or less. But the amount of funding they receive is far less than the amount of funding that's received
oh,
by
sure.
mainstream psychology departments.
And I would guess that, you know, with the economy the way it is worldwide, it's going to dry up probably in those areas.
I don't think it'll dry up completely. Some of these faculties still rely on donations from wealthy private individuals who are interested in having this research done.
That's probably where the money will only come from. Individuals who like the subject matter.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised. The United States government and other governments have funded quite a bit of research into these areas. There's, you know, the U.S. government, the CIA Stargate program. So,
do you think those programs are still continuing? Maybe a little more clandestine?
I think they're still continuing. I think that they're.
I do too.
They're just probably not broadcasting or advertising it as much as they used to.
I wonder what really got them interested in the field.
Well, I think it was the activity of the Russians. The Russians have been rumored to, you know, during the Cold War, they'd been rumored to be involved in researching these sorts of things for decades. So that's what I think was the motivation behind the CIA's Stargate project.
In the areas that you have looked at for your work, for example, science and psychic phenomena, what would you say you've uncovered? Is there anything startlingly different than what most of us think might be out there?
Hmm. Well, remember this book that we're talking about right now, Science and Psychic Phenomena. It's the first in a series of three. So I assume you want to restrict my remarks.
Sure.
To this first book. Have I encountered anything startlingly different? No, I suppose that anything that might be startling is actually the scandalous nature of the debate over the reality of psychic abilities such as telepathy, the so-called psi phenomena. What really startled me and startles a lot of people is, well, first of all, the fact that the experimental evidence was considered overwhelmingly strong by the 1950s because of the work of people like Joseph Banks Ryan at Duke University and
right.
others. And just the way that Ryan and many of the modern scientists have been treated by the so-called skeptical community.
Did you come across any book in your work, Breakthrough to Creativity, by Shafika Karegula?
No, I can't say that I have.
Okay, she was my aunt. She was one of the first psychiatrists in our country, Chris, who devoted her entire practice to the field of telepathy and psychic abilities. She was fascinated by it. She just changed her whole practice into this arena. She died. Strangely, a radio fell into her tub, but she was on the cutting edge years ago in this field. And gosh, had she still been alive, I think she really would have come a long way in this field. How do you think it works? What do you think it is? These psychic abilities that we have, some are better than most. How do you think it works?
Well, it's quite clear that they don't work according to any principles of classical physics, that is, the physics of Isaac Newton. Classical physics is very mechanistic and has materialistic assumptions. All causation within classical physics is mechanistic because the world since Isaac Newton, or after Isaac Newton, I should say, was viewed as a gigantic clockwork mechanism. And this is where the distinction between the natural and the supernatural first arose, because scientific explanations were meant to be mechanistic, that is, because of direct contact between neighboring entities. And super, so therefore, any other sort of influence, such as second sight, being able to see the future in dreams, telepathy, whatever, those were labeled as supernatural because they were thought to have a non-mechanistic or be an example of non-mechanistic causation. However, classical physics, as you probably know, has been known to be fundamentally and grossly incorrect since the early years of the 20th century. And modern physics, known as quantum mechanics, does allow non-mechanical causation. For instance, the collapse of the wave function by conscious observation is one example. Another example is non-locality, where we have instantaneous influence between two quantum entities, often at a great distance, with no signal transmitted between them. Einstein was disturbed by this, and he called it spooky action, yeah. Action at a distance. But my point is that although classical physics has difficulty accommodating the reality of psychic phenomena, quantum mechanics has no such difficulty. And so certain theorists, such as the physicist even Harris Walker, have proposed models of how these abilities might work based upon extensions of the orthodox quantum mechanics.
There's something, I've always called it, Chris, the wireless internet that's out there that somehow interconnects all of us together. So if some person is thinking about someone and, you know, that person calls or they walk into them turning around the corner of a building or something, I think there's a connection there between that. Has science tried to find that connection? Are there experiments ongoing out there now to look for this?
Between people, you mean?
Between this entire field of psychic phenomena. Anything that's going on that's public?
Well, I think that that's at this point in time, that's more or less theoretical speculation only. There's speculation, as I said, that many of these abilities operate or exploit quantum non-locality. And that's where particles which have had some interaction in the past, perhaps starting from a common source, actually share a property, and the property and they're allowed to influence each other instantaneously, no matter how far away, how far apart they are from each other. So it's speculated that these sorts of non-local influences may explain why, for instance, the operation of telepathy seems unaffected by distance and unaffected by shielding of any sort.
You know, some people have used these techniques for their day-to-day living. I mean, there's no question that they, you know, have these intuitive abilities. We've all used them in some form or fashion. Yet, we've had psychics on the air. We've had all kinds of people on the air. It's difficult to get hard evidence, to get hard proof. Have you found any of that?
Depends what you mean by hard evidence. Are you talking about spontaneous?
Something that's really tangible that you can take and say, look, this person is doing this or that.
Right. Well, the problem with psychic abilities, at least in the experiments, is that they're real. They're definitely real, but they're also low-level effects. In other words, they're not particularly strong. Rupert Sheldrake, he's the biologist who wrote the foreword to my book.
Right, and he's been on our program a lot.
Right. Well, he's done several experiments with animals in ESP. And from his studies with animals, he's concluded that, and I quote, he wrote, telepathy usually occurs between animals that are bonded with each other, and that in schools, flocks, herds, packs, and other social groups, telepathic communication may play an important role in the coordination of the activity of the group. Also, at least in birds and mammals, telepathy has to do with emotions, needs, and intentions. Feelings communicated telepathically include fear, alarm, excitement, calls for help, calls to go to a particular place, anticipation of arrivals, departures, distress, and dying. And he's also concluded that psi abilities that he's discussed in his work, quote, are better developed in animals than in people. Normally, dogs seem to be the most sensitive, followed by cats, horses, and parrots, with humans trailing far behind.
That's pretty fascinating. I had not heard of that.
Yeah.
You know, we've always known that our pets were pretty intuitive or psychically inclined. But why are humans so far behind? We've got to be putting up a barrier somewhere, aren't we?
Well, perhaps it's our more highly developed cerebral cortex. Perhaps we rely more on our five ordinary senses, and we've somewhat forgotten about our other abilities. I think that I have a whole chapter on historical evidence, and I have a lot of striking examples of human beings using these abilities to do quite remarkable things.
Give me one.
Well, it depends. Would you like one from the ancient world? Would you like one from the Second World War? Or would you like one from Zulus?
How about the Second World War?
Okay. Here's one I wrote about called Churchill's Close Call. And I'm reading from my book here. In her autobiography, Lady Churchill recalled that after a tour of inspection he made during the Blitz of London, Winston Churchill was about to get into a staff car on the near side, as he always did, when for no apparent reason he stopped and got into the other side of the car instead, something Lady Churchill had never known him to do before. While being driven back, a bomb fell near the car.
Oh, my.
Lifting it up on its two near side wheels. Had Churchill been sitting on that side as usual, the car would have turned over. Only Winston's extra weight had prevented disaster, Lady Churchill said. Later, when asked by his wife why he had changed his mind getting into the car, Churchill said that something made him stop in a way that told him he was meant to sit on the other side. Churchill said, I sometimes have a feeling, in fact, I have it very strongly, a feeling of interference, he told a gathering of miners later in the war. I have a feeling sometimes that some guiding hand has interfered. End of quote.
That's a great story. And you know what? I bet we can cite hundreds, if not thousands, of episodes that have happened to people where they were saved. You know, I talk about one with me, Chris, and in terms of going through a four intersection, and I stopped at a green light because something told me not to go through the intersection. And when I stopped, somebody had gone through their red light. They would have smashed right into me. I have no idea what triggered me to do that. It hasn't happened then. It hasn't happened ever, but this one time. But something was so compelling in me. It kept saying, stop, don't go through, just don't go through. And I stopped. There's something there that gives us that. I'm just wondering, do you think it's biological, part of the brain, or is it truly part of the subconscious?
Difficult to say.
Or both?
Well, I think it may very well involve some aspects of our brain. It does seem to be, at least real life size, seems to just happen. It does seem to be largely self-conscious. But there are some people who will try to make themselves more receptive, shall we say, to using these abilities.
Chris, part of your website uses the word the skeptics. So when we come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, I want to ask you what that all means. How skeptical can the skeptics really be? If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com, and we shall be right back. Don't touch your dial. Questions or stories about your psychic abilities? That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your calls in a second. Our guest, Chris Carter. Chris, you also did some work with your book, Science and the Near-Death Experience. What did you conclude about these near-death experiences?
The near-death experiences. Oh, the second book.
It's your book, right?
Yes.
Okay, and what did you conclude by it?
kind of like telling you the end of the movie, isn't it?
Depends if it's a good movie.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but I eventually ended up concluding that the near-death experience is exactly what it appears to be. That is, a genuine separation of mind from body during the early stages of biological death. I examined virtually all of the proposed physiological and psychological explanations or alternative explanations for the near-death experience, and I found that not one of them stood up to critical scrutiny.
Not one?
No, not at all. You know, there's the usual, the oxygen deprivation, the seizures and so forth, and no, none of them, not one stood up to critical scrutiny.
What about so many people who claim that, you know, grandma from the other side has come back to talk to them, or there's something else going on? What's happening to them?
Are you referring to near-death experiences?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's several stages of near-death experience, and they don't necessarily all happen in the same order, and they don't all necessarily happen in the same near-death experience. But some are more frequent than others. The most commonly reported experience would be feelings of peace and joy.
Right.
Usually at the beginning of the experience. Another fairly common experience is the out-of-body experience, viewing either their body lying on the floor or a resuscitation effort from a position above the body. They may encounter a tunnel. They may pass through the tunnel towards a bright light. If the experience proceeds any farther, they may encounter some beings, either a mysterious being of light who asks some questions about their lives, or they may encounter deceased friends and relatives.
So when one dies, in your opinion, what happens? That's it? All done?
According to materialism, which is an ancient philosophy dating back to at least ancient Greece, all things have a physical cause. And so therefore, the brain produces the mind, and the mind is at most a useless byproduct of brain activity. And so according to this, when the brain ceases to function, the mind must also cease to function. One of the alternative theories is that the brain works as a two-way receiver-transmitter. This, again, is an ancient theory dating back at least to Hippocrates.
Mm-hmm.
And according to this theory, as I said, the brain works as a two-way receiver-transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, and other times from mind to body, as in willed action. Now, some of the materialists will say, well, if that's true, well, how can we explain the fact that intoxication can affect a person's behavior, can affect their mental functioning? How can we explain that injuries such as a stroke can affect a person's mental performance, even their personality? Well, the thing is that any injury or impairment of the brain is certainly going to affect the brain's capacity as a receiver-transmitter, just as certainly as it would affect its capacity as a producer.
Sure.
You know, under both theories, the operation and manifestation of mind is going to be affected. The advantage of the transmission hypothesis over the production hypothesis is that the transmission hypothesis can explain many sorts of phenomena which remain utterly inexplicable according to the theory of production.
In your website, you talk about parapsychology and the skeptics. What do the skeptics all say about all of this? I mean, is it nothing exists, this doesn't happen? Or are they open a little bit to the possibility that some of this could occur?
Well, there are variations, but I'd like to say something about skepticism, first of all.
Sure.
You know, genuine skepticism is a crucially important part of science. New scientific claims must be subjected to the most severe critical scrutiny if we are to minimize our chances of mistakenly accepting false claims. But genuine skepticism is the practice of doubt. It's not the practice of denial.
And that could be healthy.
The practice of doubt is certainly healthy.
Of course.
Yes, absolutely. Otherwise, we'd just be gullible.
Yep.
But that's not what these skeptics of parapsychology are practicing. They're not, for the most part, they're not practicing doubt. They're practicing denial, which means that they're not genuine skeptics. They're merely deniers.
And they've already got their agenda, I think, before they even probe or investigate.
That's right. They've got their minds made up. You have to understand, as I said earlier, if this were any other field of study, the data would have been convincing to everyone by 1950 due to the work of Joseph Banks Ryan and others. But parapsychology is not like any other field of study. The data of parapsychology challenge deeply held worldviews that are concerned not only with science, but also with religious and philosophical issues. And as such, the data arouse strong passions in many, and for many, a strong desire to dismiss them.
Let's take some phone calls here, Chris. We'll go to Raymond, first of all, in Pueblo, Colorado. Raymond, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have a couple of questions. I want to know what you think is the difference between telepathy and intuition. I have a lot of experiences where I can kind of just give an educated guess and usually right. And I've always kind of said, well, I think I'm a little psychic, but I don't know what the real difference is between that. Also, a couple other things that I'd like to consider are what the connection is with the ability and or psychic ability and dreams. I've always believed that in a dream you're seeing someone who's having the same sort of dream or same sort of connection, and you just consciously don't know it. I mean, unless you talk to the person, you may not have even seen the person in years. Is there any sort of connection between those? And do you think it has to do anything with what was discussed the other night with the heart and mind sort of thinking, with your heart thinking?
Okay, we'll take some of that. In terms of telepathy and intuition, Chris, do you want to give us some of your own thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, for me, intuition refers to a sort of non-linear way of thinking. It's kind of like you think about a problem, you just can't seem to find the solution. Then you perhaps go for a walk and you think about something else, and all of a sudden the idea pops into your mind. I don't think that's necessarily involves psychic abilities such as telepathy or clairvoyance, in most cases at least. I think that's more that your mind is organizing information in a different way such that it can suddenly put all the pieces together and see the puzzle. I can't say if that's true in every case. Perhaps in some cases, great intuitive insights have had a telepathic or clairvoyant component to them. But I think that most psychologists would argue that intuition, although it's mysterious, really, in most cases, doesn't have much to do with telepathic abilities.
In terms of dreams, I've always felt, Chris, that in your dream state, which is very powerful, you have the ability to do things, concentrate on people, get things done, solve your problems. I think dreams are very powerful. What about you?
I think so, too. I think that ordinary dreams can be very powerful. But throughout history, there have been many reports of precognitive dreams, that is, dreams that have seemed to foretell the future. Probably the most famous in history is the dream of Abraham Lincoln, in which he seems to have foresaw his own death.
His own death, yeah.
Yeah, which I discuss in my book, in Chapter 3. There have been other cases of prophetic dreams within history. This has actually been studied experimentally as well. There was the dream labs. I can't remember the name of them, Malmonades or Malmonoids or something. It was set up in the 1970s, and they had a fair amount of success. What they were doing was they were trying to project images at people who were dreaming, and then waking them up and seeing if there's any correspondence between their dreams and what they were trying to project towards them. They had some success, but the problem is that these dream laboratories are notoriously expensive to fund. And so dream laboratories closed down.
I've always wondered if governments were using people to enter other people's dreams to have them die of heart attacks or something like that.
No.
Sounds like another Hollywood movie.
Yeah, it sounds more like a Hollywood movie.
Let's go to Agawam, Massachusetts. Eileen, I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, George. Listen, I wanted to tell you, I used to be a personal live-in assistant to an elderly man in a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
And the story of how he got in the wheelchair was 30 years ago, he had a 12-year-old daughter. He was he had a girlfriend, and he was financially independent. He was taking flying lessons, learning how to fly a Cessna, small Cessna airplane. And in the middle of February, he was going to go flying on a Saturday. But Friday night, the night before his flying lesson, his girlfriend said, "I had the most horrible feeling. If you get on that airplane, something awful is going to happen. If you love me, don't get on that airplane." So he said, "Okay, I won't." So the next day, he took his 12-year-old daughter sledding instead. And he had a sledding accident where he suffered a spinal cord injury, and he was in a wheelchair the rest of his life.
Oh, my.
So that's just this very mind-twisting thing of, you know, which door should he have gone through, the airplane or the sled, or, and what was up with his girlfriend that she just knew something was going to happen.
It's almost as if you cannot press fate, and whatever happens is going to happen, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree with that. I'm just looking at chapter 3 of my book here. There has been some research on that. You know, I mean,
the unavoidable.
Yeah, the question is, you know, are these glimpses of what will happen
or could happen,
only what might happen if steps are not taken to avoid it? Louisa Rhine, she was the wife of J.B. Rhine, who I mentioned earlier. She actually probed this question in great detail. She examined 433 cases in which the foreseen event was so unpleasant that anyone would want to prevent it. I'm reading from my book here. In about two-thirds of the cases, no attempt was made to prevent the event because the person simply forgot, feared ridicule, or for some other reason. In the end, she was left with 191 cases in which people had attempted to prevent the foreseen event from taking place. In 31% of the cases, the attempted intervention was unsuccessful, most often because the psychic experience had not provided enough information to allow the experient to prevent the occurrence. However, in the remaining cases, 69%, the people were able to take adequate steps to prevent the event, or at least to avoid some of the undesirable consequences. And here's an example in Louisa Rhine's own words. She wrote, "It concerns a mother who dreamed that 2 hours later a violent storm would loosen a heavy chandelier to fall directly on her baby's head lying in a crib below it. In the dream, she saw her baby killed dead. She awoke her husband, who said it was a silly dream and that she should go back to sleep. The weather was so calm, the dream did appear ridiculous, and she could have gone back to sleep. But she did not. She went and brought the baby back to her own bed. 2 hours later, just at the time she specified, a storm caused the heavy light fixture to fall right on where the baby's head had been, but the baby was not there to be killed by it."
That's miraculous, too. I think you can change destiny, I guess.
Well, cases like this suggest that the individual sees not the actual future, but rather the potential event that might occur. So, you know, this suggests that the future exists not deterministically, but rather as a range of possibilities, and that our human intervention may affect which of those events of varying probability actually do occur.
Of course, I wish some government leaders would have this ability. Maybe we all wouldn't be in this mess that we continually get into. Would be nice. Next up, let's go to Bevan in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Bevan, go ahead.
Hey, glad to talk to you guys.
Sure thing.
I am just seeing someone, and I've never had this happen before, but oftentimes we will wake up in the morning and have dreams that have they're not the same dream, but very similar content, like turkey sandwiches or just something, a situation that's completely similar, and I've never had psychic experiences or anything, but I just thought this was very unusual that just sleeping next to someone, it almost seems like we're interacting in some, you know, extrasensory world. And I was just wondering how you might speak to that.
Well, I think everybody has the ability to have some kind of psychic challenge somewhere, somehow. I think everybody has it in them, whether you train or not. Chris, as you are doing your research for your works, have you concluded, you know, that people do have this ability? They might not use it. They might not know how to use it, but they all have it.
Well, it's really impossible to say, isn't it?
Have you used it?
Well, have I had unusual experiences?
Yeah.
Yes, I have. Of course I have. I don't like to talk about them because if I do that, I set myself up as an easy target for the so-called skeptics.
Sure.
People always attack the weakest, flimsiest evidence and ignore the strongest. And in my book, I do exactly the opposite. I always focus my heavy guns on my opponent's strongest defenses.
Of course.
Because if you blow holes in your opponent's strongest arguments, the effect is devastating, and they're left with nothing.
One of the opponents out there, one of the skeptics, of course, the Amazing Randy, he's got this so-called $1 million in escrow somewhere, and yet no person with psychic abilities has been able to take that. I don't know why.
Oh, well, what you said is not exactly true. There's a lot of problems with that. The major problem is, of course, that Randy himself acts as a policeman, judge, and jury. And so he's hardly an unbiased observer. You know, he said countless disparaging, insulting remarks concerning parapsychology, and he has a financial stake in the debunking movement. So he's hardly unbiased. And, you know, it's Randy who decides who will be tested and...
And who gets it and who doesn't.
Well, the thing is, as far as I'm aware, he's never actually tested anyone. He's got something called a preliminary test. And as far as I know, he's never let anyone pass it. And he's also refused to test certain people and has ignored challenges to be tested.
Well, then it's pretty difficult for anybody to get that money, isn't it?
It's impossible. I don't believe his money was ever in danger. He's backed down from homeopath John Bennett. He backed down from a challenge issued by Dr. Jewel Eisenbud, who wagered him $10,000 that he could not duplicate the thought photography of Ted Sears, even with the aid of a prop in which a gimmick could be stored.
And as you know, this situation's been going on for a long, long time. We're going to take this break. We're going to come back in a moment. I'm going to take your call specifically as we deal with your psychic abilities. I want you to share one of your stories with us. We'll be right back.